in this country after the partition is the formation of linguistic states. In every linguistic state, citizens of other languages who speak other languages are de jure citizens, but in actuality they are secondary citizens. And we have such secondary citizens throughout the country. I shall dilate on this problem of language at some length in one of my future talks. Then there are fraction citizenships. Women, untouchables, and Adivasis are not whole numbers. They are not integers, but fractions of humanity. They are not recognized as having a whole soul, except in theory. In actual life, a woman has never been regarded as a human being. She is still a thing, property, movable property, at the absolute disposal of her husband. And it's a tragic fact of modern times that women in Europe and America have begun to envy the family life of India, which is based on the secondary role of the woman. So these four kinds of citizenships we have, and with all this we have all declared that under the Constitution every citizen in this country, notwithstanding his caste, creed, religion, color or sex, will be equal. You perhaps have heard of George Orwell. George Orwell has written a very marvelous book, The Animal Farm. I shall paraphrase what he has said in my own humble fashion. This is not what he has written, but this is what I have understood. I shall try to amplify what he has said. There was an animal farm where different kinds of animals lived. Once these animals thought, if we want to live together, we must have some code of conduct. And that code of conduct should be embodied in a constitution, in a written constitution. So they all assembled, and the first preamble was drafted. We, the animals of farm, this farm, assembled in this August Constituent Assembly, give unto ourselves on this day this constitution. So that was the preamble. Then the first article was moved. No animal shall kill another animal. The cat stood up What do you mean? Shall I not eat mice from tomorrow? Have you ever been used to drafting constitutions? Have our forefathers ever tried this game? Were they adepts at framing constitutions? You have no notion of what a constitution is. So the First Amendment was moved. No animal shall kill another animal without cause. So the First Amendment nullified the first article. Then came the second article. All animals are equal. The elephants stood up, and the military chargers and stallions also stood up. What do you mean? Are we, the elephant said, are we equal to these pigs? And the horses said, are we equal to these asses, these donkeys? What sort of constitution is this, which has no sense of proportion? So the second amendment was moved. All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. So the Kannadiga in Karnataka is more equal than others. The Maharashtrian in Maharashtra is more equal than others. The Bengali in Bengal is more equal than others. And all are more equal than others in some part of the country or the other. So we have citizenships that are more equal, not citizenships that are equal. I put it to young men, are you going to do something about this? Who will be the central figure of this revolution? Who will bring about this revolution? In a country which has been boasting of the philosophy of Advaita, and which has not only apartheid but also untouchability. Friends, we have not only classes and linguistic differences but castes. I shall define caste before I close for the day. What is caste? Class can be changed. You can change your caste, but you cannot change your caste. Because caste is based on birth, and you cannot change your birth. So, communalism is more liberal than casteism, because caste is exclusive. While the communalist converts you to his way of persuasion, to his faith, but caste excludes everyone else. Have you ever heard of a Brahman going about converting people into the caste Brahmins? You have heard of Muslims proselytizing others. You have heard of Christians, even of Sikhs and Buddhas. But no caste can go about proselytizing. So the first characteristic of caste is that it has only one door, the door of exit. It has no door of entrance. This is the first characteristic. The second characteristic is that it shuns human company. The farther you are from man, the nearer you are to God. If I come to Bangalore, I happen to be a Maharashtra Brahman, and if I tell you that I would eat out of no man's hand except the hand of a Maharashtra Rigvedi Brahman, you will regard me as a very pure soul, as a man of very high piety. And if I say, I don't eat anywhere else except my own house, then I rise further in your estimation. Then if I say, I don't eat out of food prepared even by my wife, I cook for myself, then I am almost at the apex. There is one rung only to send me to heaven straight. If I tell you, I don't eat food even cooked by myself. Then my piety is at its apex. That is caste. So caste is anti-social. And every revolutionary will have to bid a respectful farewell and give a decent burial in all humanity to the caste. Because the man who is at a disadvantage at a caste, in a caste, has no other alternative except changing his religion. Where have all these Muslims and Christians come from? They are all children of the caste system. So Muslim communalism in India is an offspring of the caste system among the Hindus. So the eradication of communalism depends on the eradication of caste. It is playing so much havoc in this country, playing havoc in all walks of life, particularly in our politics. But I welcome caste's entry into politics, for the simple reason because two candidates belonging to the same caste are bound to oppose each other. Every party will set up a candidate which belongs to the caste which is more numerous in a political, rather long and tedious. I have attempted to show that if we want to start a revolution in this country, we have first to ask ourselves, who will make the revolution? Will it be the state? Will it be the capitalist minority which has the power of wealth? Will it be the soldier with his sword? If it is the soldier, it will be a society dominated by soldiers, the society after revolution. If it is the capitalist, He will purchase your revolution. And if it is the state, the super trophy of the state will inflate to dangerous proportions, which will perhaps contain it, all human beings, in its capacious maw. So in this introductory talk, I wanted to bring to your notice that it is the maker of revolution that we have to find out. This is the first quest in the revolution that we want to bring about. And God willing, let us hope and trust that the young men of this country shall not be found wanting. In the lexicon of youth, the word impossibility doesn't occur. The word impossibility and the word defeat. There will be failures, but failures are not defeat. Failure may spur us on to great efforts, greater efforts. With this hope, I thank you all for listening to this talk with such great patience. Namaskar. Together engaged in an inquiry. This is not an expression of views or conclusions. I have arrived at no conclusions and I have no views. Such views as I have had have fallen with my hair. So, if I say that my mind is empty in many respects, I would request you to believe me. Yesterday, we tried to inquire about what constitutes a revolutionary mind, and also tried to learn what could be the attributes of a revolutionary. Today, I think it would be a very pertinent question to ask, whom is this revolution going to benefit? Who is going to profit by this revolution? And I shall begin by relating a parable. There were two brothers in a big town. You may call them whatever you like, blockhead and numbskull, if you like. Now, blockhead was the elder of the two. One evening, they went out for a walk. Having nothing else to talk about, the elder brother, seeing a vast plain, empty, vacant outside the town, asked his brother, just as a pastime, what will you do if this piece of land was given to you? the younger brother in equally frivolous mood replied, "I shall turn this into a rose garden." This irritated the elder brother. He said, "You have always been a primrose pather. You have never been serious in life. You are thinking of planting a rose garden in this land when so many of our people are dying for want of enough food to eat. So you seem to me entirely, utterly impervious to the sufferings of your fellow men." So the younger brother asked his elder brother, "What would you do, sir, if this land is given to you?" He said, "Well, I will sow wheat here." The younger brother said, "If I am a primrose father, you are a hard mill grinder. You can think of nothing but your tummy, of your stomach. You don't seem to have any sense of aesthetics." So this simple conversation developed into a heated argument. The elder brother asked, "Had your father ever planted a rose garden?" Now their father was the same, because they were brothers born of the same parents. The younger brother also spoke in rather lost his temper and asked, "If my father had never planted a rose garden, had your father and grandfather ever plowed a field in their lives?" So they began to exchange compliments in parliamentary parlance. And ultimately they came to blows. Both were wounded and both fell on the roadside. An old man, experienced man, was passing and he saw these two young men lying wounded by the roadside. He stopped and asked them what the matter was. They said, "There was this dispute between us about this land." He said, "It's very natural. Who are you?" "We are two brothers born of the same parents." "So what else could you do? There is always fight between brothers for property. Who else could fight for the same property? So you needn't be very repentant about what has happened. Needn't feel ashamed. But would you mind answering one question? To whom does this land belong?" And both said, "Well, it never occurred to us to ask ourselves this question." We were planning 5-year plans and 10-year plans, devising, planning, making various schemes how this land could be used. But it never occurred to us whether we should ask ourselves this fundamental question: to whom does this land belong? And this is, I think, the most crucial question that every revolutionary must ask himself. Who will inherit this earth? Will this earth belong to anyone? Will it belong to the man who can conquer it by his sword, or to the man who can purchase it? Will it belong to the sword, the purse, or the king? To whom shall this earth belong? That's the most crucial question, because there are more people on this earth who are deprived of their inheritance. They are driven from post to pillar. The law, in its majesty, forbids them to sleep under bridges, to sit and live on the pavements, to beg bread on the streets, and to steal from houses where there are heaps of bread. They have no place, not even a few inches to stand upon God's earth. And we have been chanting almost every day, Prithvitvaya Adhruta Loka Devitvam Vishnuna Adhruta Tvanch Dharaya Man Devi. You have been bearing us upon our breast. Vishnu has been bearing you, supporting you. Mother Earth, would you support me? And this question, asked by the destitute and the poor, has never been answered. So who is it who needs the revolution? Are those who are well entrenched in life, in the present social order? Those who enjoy status and prestige in the present social order? They do not need the revolution. Any social change will be to their disadvantage. Therefore, the revolutionaries call them the vested interests. It is in their interest to maintain the status quo. So it is this last man who has to be the maker of this revolution. Not only the man who will be benefited, not only the beneficiary of the revolution, but the maker of the revolution. Therefore, this revolution has to be brought about in the context of democracy and by democratic methods, whether constitutional, extra-constitutional, or unconstitutional, but democratic. Democratic means peaceful. We calculate it to bring men nearer to each other. A revolution that will not prove divisive. A technique of revolution which will be cohesive. So in our vision of this revolution, all progress means advance, and all advance means approach. Approaching one another, coming nearer to one another. So we have to explore, to find out a technique of revolution that will bring men closer together than they are today, closer in mind. Because if men come close together merely in body and not in mind, what will happen? They will not embrace each other, but they will wrestle with each other. The process is the same. In wrestling also, you have to embrace one another. But as Harold Laski once wrote, I embrace my enemy to better to choke him. So this embrace of death is not calculated to bring about any revolution that will be human in the sense, a revolution that will bring each man closer to his brother. This, friends, this is not a question of violence or non-violence. The fundamental question in democracy is, who will be the supreme authority? The soldier or the citizen? Who will depend upon whom? Will the soldier depend upon the citizen, or the citizen depend upon the soldier? What will be the sanction of our democratic order? Whether force or consent? Whether the final arbiter will be the ploughman or the hangman? I had a heart-to-heart talk with a very enlightened gentleman this afternoon, and he told me there can be no morality without fear. And I can tell you from what I know and what I feel and from what I have experienced, fear is the dark room in which all negatives are developed. The morality which rests on fear is a counterfeit morality. It's a misnomer. That is why our ultimate sanction in the other world is Yamaraj, the god of death, who metes out punishments. It's not Lord Vishnu, the preserver. We worship him, but in the heart of our hearts we pay tribute to Yamaraj, who after all seems to be the power behind Vishnu. Our pandits and shastris often say, agratash chaturo vedah prushtatash sasharan dhanu. The Vedas, the glory of the Vedas rests on the arrow and the bow. Quran when in one hand and sword in the other. Bible in one hand and crusades in the other. What does it mean? It means that it is brute force, physical power, on which our democracy rests today. The citizen is sovereign under the constitution, but in actuality it is the soldier on whom the citizen depends. So what does this revolution signify? What is its objective? We want to liberate the plowshare and other means and instruments of production from the domination of the purse, from the dread and infatuation of the sword, and from the abject subservience to the throne, which is the symbol of the state under any social order. This is the primary aim of the revolution. Of every revolutionary in the world, belonging to whatever persuasion. I am reminded of the Third International held in Moscow in 1919, which declared the aims of communism. Communism, as it is understood in Russia. Because communism also is not the same everywhere. There is communism of the Russian orientation, there is communism of the Maoist orientation, and there is communism of the Shankaran Namdripad variety, and the Naxalite variety, Jyoti Bosu variety, Dange variety. So we have several brands of communism. In his book on communism, Harold Lasky at last wrote, communism is like a hat that has lost its shape because everyone wears it. That is what is happening to our concept of the revolution also. But this is a digression. I was referring to what the Third International in Moscow laid out as the aims of communism. The first was to end the domination of capital. The second was to wipe out state boundaries. And the third was to make war impossible. So it was not Gandhi who for the first time uttered that war was inhuman, detrimental to the evolution of humanity. It was Karl Marx who for the first time uttered this truth which will hold out for all times to come. This is a timeless truth that he uttered, and he alone had the courage. No religious leader, no rishi or saint, no prophet before Karl Marx had the courage or the vision, the far sight to utter this truth. Every religion prescribes dana, charity. And the Christian scripture says, poverty was designed with a view to charity. Unless you have poverty, you can't have charity. So you have to be bounteous, generous to the poor. But there must be some people who suffer from want in order to provide you with an opportunity for charity. So every religion has prescribed charity, but no religion has asserted with the definiteness with which Marx asserted that there will come a day when there will be neither poor nor rich on this land. And there will come a day when there will be no wars. He never asked whether this was possible. As I told you yesterday, revolution is the art of making the impossible possible, the possible probable, and the probable feasible. A revolutionary mind is not pragmatic. Pragmatism, as a matter of fact, doesn't exist in any of our relationships. Jamnalal Bajaj was a very pragmatic man. He once sought to define what pragmatism meant, because I wanted to learn. I have been regarded as a most impractical chap, because I don't believe in practicalism, which doesn't exist anywhere. Jamnalalji said, when you have to receive money, receive the money first and give the receipt afterwards. When you have to give money, receive the receipt first and give the money afterwards. One of those young men who used to live with me then listened to Jamnalalji's remark, and I had learned a new lesson. So I came home and recited it to my family. Happened to go to Nagpur from Wardha. I asked that young man to buy a ticket for me. I was on the point of missing the train. When I looked for him, and there he was standing at the window of the booking office. I said, "Why are you standing here? Why didn't you purchase the ticket?" Said that an argument has started between this booking clerk and me. He says he would have the money first, and I say I would have the ticket first. So perhaps he would have waited there till the Greek calendar, till the end of time. Ask yourselves whether you ever act in that fashion. Can there be any documents about corruption, about bribery? If I promise the booking clerk 5 rupees for a ticket, does he give me any receipt? Or do I give him any assurance in writing? If men want to sing together, there has to be basic faith among themselves. That is the beauty of togetherness, because there can be no life in isolation. Life means relationship, and relationship is based on mutual faith. If men didn't believe each other, they couldn't sin together. If you want to commit a murder with other companions, there has to be good faith amongst you, which they call honor among thieves. In Shakespeare's Richard III occurs a very fine sentence in one of his stanzas.